Welcome to Off the Page, the showcase podcast of the Creative Writing Society at the University of Nottingham. This episode is hosted by me, Matthew Bird, the president of the society.
And me, Madeline Roach, the webmaster.
This is URN.
As always, this episode of Off the Page will contain pieces written by members of the Creative Writing Society.
You can visit uncws.com to find out more about the society and to visit our blog to read even more pieces by the members.
So the first piece we have is a short story by Megan.
It's a short story called Daughter that I, based on a prompt from a Lit Circle a while back, believe it was a Jane Austen prompt about the truth universally acknowledged that, what is it, a woman with fortune must be once of a husband. It has long been known that woman is made to fit into the slender space carved out for her by the will of man. The layers of her garments, whether the simple attire she wears to sleep, or the elaborate dresses she must don to accompany her lord, are cut from social fabric. They form the divide that bars her from the lands beyond the walls of his castle. The boundaries of his domain constitute the sum of her world. The daughter picks up a blade, delivered into her hands from the callous grasp of her father. They call him ruthless, calculating, the viper. He teaches her all he knows, the skills imparted to him by his own father, or picked up like bright, precious stones as he trod the path from monastery to market to the province he now rules. He schools her to be rational, a stoic and gentle beauty, as he is expected to. For where is the purpose of disturbing order where there is no need? But alongside this, he shows her thrusts, feints, blocks and parries. In the company of her cousin, she moves wooden soldiers across a faded map of a land that has torn itself apart for a century or more. A land that will continue to do so, unless there is one willing and able to take on the task of uniting a myriad of warring states. She gathers what she needs, shielded by the embrace of shadows and a soft, deceptive smile. Their weak points become her strengths. Their follies and slips of the tongue, she sends back to the man who made her, set down on parchment in subtle lamplight haste. He calls her fondly by her name, one of her many names, and embraces her. Against his robes, dyed the gaudy yet inviting blue of a midday wave, she settles into a child's blind trust. He is her cocoon, a place of nurture and shelter, and she believes in his constancy. He will be, continue to be, until a day now absent from her thoughts, when she must seize her wings of steel and stand alone. This is her reward. This, and something greater to be found upon breaking from her husband's arms, when he is forced to turn the sword upon himself. Something that is, in this moment, unknown and unthinkable. For even when the evidence will be presented with such clarity, with the years lined up as a succession of witnesses to her capabilities, she is merely the viper's daughter.
I still remember when you submitted this piece to critiques, and I was really fond of this damn piece.
Well, like, thanks.
This piece is still like, it's just a good damn piece. It's just like, it tells a whole story in a few paragraphs, even though you could potentially make it into a whole novel. It also stands on its own really well.
Oh, spoilers, I am.
And the next piece is a short story by Joe, written in the description Lit Circle.
It's called Everything. A stapler is an item that contains staples and staples these staples to paper. A staple is a piece of metal. A piece of paper is a tree, just a really, really thin tree, or rather bark. Bark is wood. Bark comes from trees. Trees are tall. They are green. They are made of wood and leaves, so many leaves. Leaves are also green. Leaves are made of green. Grass is made of green. Grass is on the ground. The ground is made of grass and dirt and soil. Dirt and soil are dirty and soily. Dirt and soil are brown. Poo is brown. Poo can be found in dirt and soil. Plants can grow in dirt and soil, but not poo. Plants are poo. Or rather, humans eat plants and the plants become poo. Jesus, what is a human? Jesus, what is Jesus? Jesus is a human. A human is a mammal. No, I don't have time to explain what a mammal is. A human is a living thing. It has a head, a body, legs. A head is at the head of a person, which is on the body, which is on the legs, which are on the feet. In the head there is a brain. The brain controls the body and the legs and the feet. The brain is like a supercomputer and... Fuck! A supercomputer. A supercomputer is a computer that is super. A computer is a really smart piece of metal. A staple is a piece of metal. What is metal? Metal comes from the ground, you know, where the grass and the dirt and the soil and the poop are. Metal is in ores. Ores can also be used for rowing, and they are made of wood. Wood that comes from trees and makes paper. Paper? Oh, here we are again. Stapling the paper with a stapler. Made of plastic. For fuck's sake. Plastic, that's from dead animals. Animals, fuck animals are. Well, humans are animals. Elephants are animals. Oh, elephants. They have heads too. Big heads. And big fucking ears. Like ears the size of elephants. And they have tusks. And these tusks are made from ivory. And ivory comes from elephant tusks and rhino horns. And rhinos are mammals and horns are sharp. But the horns also make noise. And noise is sound. And sound is ripples in the air. And air is, well, without air, none of this would exist. There would be no staplers or staples or metals or wood or trees or grass or poo or Jesus or computers or elephants without air. Air is the key to everything. And air contains...
The prompt for that piece was in a lit circle, and it was describe a thing from the perspective of someone who has no idea what anything is. So this piece was also written for the same prompt, describing something from the perspective of someone who has no idea what it is. Right, so this doesn't make any sense. You're saying because this bit of paper has a face on it, it's more important than this piece of paper. But both have faces on. And you're saying this one is twice as important as that one. But it's only important because we all agree it's important. Well, what if I want this carrot to be important? Wait, you're saying I can use metal faces, which are worth less than the paper faces, to get more carrots? Or I could hand in this piece of paper and get carrots and metal back? No, you're the stupid one. What you're telling me is that this piece of paper is important because we all think it is, and we think it is because we decided that gold is the most important because it's difficult to dig out of the ground. I wasn't even consulted. But you keep deciding that different amounts of paper faces are worth different amounts of gold that we don't necessarily have, but pinky promise we essentially have in some way or another. Okay, now you're taking the piss. This piece of plastic doesn't even have a face on it, but you're saying it's as important as whatever I want to get, and that I can get stuff more important than the total importance that I have stored as bits and bytes on a server backed up by gold that may or may not exist. So I can have negative importance because I promised to try super, super hard in the future to become more important. Right.
And that explains the entire problem with the humanity in general.
So the next piece is a short story by Maddie.
Okay, so this is called The World Grew Dark, and it was actually... partly written in consequences, which is one of our tasks that we do sometimes. And basically what you have to do is you write a line and then you hand it to the next person, and you only see the line that was written before it to write the rest of the story. And usually it's a mess, and usually they're very, very rude and not to be read on the podcast because the society will have an awful reputation. But this one was actually really good and really clear and made sense. So I have edited it and added some bits and stuff. But yeah, it was from our mythology lit circle last year. So if it's all wrong, don't blame me. I don't know anything about mythology. Okay. The sun set on another day in Olympus, another day that Helios had to spend without Selene. The two never liked each other anyway. Maybe it was that innate sibling rivalry, or perhaps the moon was too dark and the sun was too bright. There was never a healthy medium. It truly could be considered a toxic relationship, and yet they persisted in trying to outdo each other, the sun trying to burn, the moon trying to quench her brother's flame. So one day Zeus decided to put an end to this madness and decreed that the two should never meet, only a slight cross when the moon rises and the sun sets. Each night they would wait to catch a glimpse of each other, however fleeting. They would wait for the next dusk with trepidation, but it wasn't enough. They longed to see each other always, not just at twilight. They tried to take it up with Zeus, saying that they had failed to realize their love for one another, their own blood, their own kin, until they were doomed to never be together. But the god was ruthless, firm in his decision. And so the two took it into their own hands, In those passing moments, they planned a way to be together. It took years to plan when they could only see each other for minutes at a time. They slipped past each other, hands outstretched, palms sliding against one another, trying to stay stationary just long enough to grip. They never had the time. But one day, their plan was complete, and once they took a steely breath and decided that once and for all they would be together and no one could stop them, the world grew dark. The days were no longer lit by sunlight, and the nights were black without the silvery flakes of moonlight. The world descended into dark chaos as two siblings walked away, glowing light emitting from their linked hands. And that's why you don't fuck with gods.
That is sweet and heartbreaking and like apocalyptic in a bunch of ways. Basically just yes, the classics nerd in me, even if it might not be accurate, is still very pleased by this. So
thank you.
I know.
We will break now for a book of the week.
So my recommendation for this week is Lainey Taylor's book, Strange the Dreamer. This is for anyone who's just a big fan of fantasy but wants a slightly different protagonist who's not your average sword-wielding macho man. Or even just if you want to read about someone who's more interested in his books than in learning how to fight. But I really loved this book. It isn't something I'd usually pick up, but it was recommended to me by a friend, so now I'm recommending it to all of you. Lainey Taylor's written quite a few fantasy and young adult books, including a trilogy called Daughter of Smoke and Bone, which is very popular. I've heard that she puts out a ridiculous number of books every year, so she's a really hard worker, and her writing style is absolutely beautiful. So I'm going to read to you the opening of Strange the Dreamer, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. Names may be lost or forgotten. No one knew that better than Laszlo Strange. He had another name first, but it had died like a song with no one left to sing it. Maybe it had been an old family name, burnished by generations of use. Maybe it had been given to him by someone who loved him. He liked to think so, but he had no idea. All he had were Laszlo and Strange. Strange, because that was the surname given to all foundlings in the kingdom of Zosma, and Laszlo, after a monk's tongueless uncle. He had it cut out in a prison gallery, the monk told him when he was old enough to understand. He was an eerie silent man, and you were an eerie silent baby. So it came to me, Laszlo. I had to name so many babies that year, I went with whatever popped into my head. He added, as an afterthought, didn't think you'd live anyway. That was the year Zosma sank to its knees and bled great gouts of men into a war about nothing. The war, of course, did not content itself with soldiers. Fields were burned, villages pillaged, bands of displaced peasants roamed the razed countryside, fighting the crows for gleanings. So many died that the tumbrils used to cart thieves to the gallows were repurposed to carry orphans to the monasteries and convents. They arrived like shipments of lambs to hear the monks tell it, and with no more knowledge of their provenance than the lambs either. Some were old enough to know their names at least, but Laszlo was just a baby, and an ill one, no less. Grey as rain you were, the monk said. Thought for sure you'd die, but you ate and you slept and your colour came normal in time. Never cried, not once. And that was unnatural, but we liked you for it fine. None of us became monks to be nursemaids. To which the child Laszlo replied, with a fire in his soul, well, none of us became children to the orphans. But an orphan he was, and a strange, and though he was prone to fantasy, he never had any delusions about that. Even as a little boy, he understood that there would be no revelations and no reunions. No one was coming for him, and he would never know his own true name. Which is perhaps why the mystery of Weep captured him so completely. There were two mysteries, actually, one old, one new. The old one opened his mind, but it was the new one that climbed inside, turned several circles, and settled in with a grunt, like a satisfied dragon in a cosy new lair. And there it would remain, the mystery in his mind, exhaling enigma for years to come. It had to do with a name, and the discovery that, in addition to being lost or forgotten, names could also be stolen.
Ooh.
And that is the opening of Strange the Dreamer. Please go read it, it's good.
I just want to read that, I have to be honest.
It is a good story, it's very good. I really like the protagonist just because he's a lot more relatable.
So, like, high fantasy? Very... I didn't realise it was, like, high... Is it, like, high fantasy?
Yes, it is.
I didn't realise it because I know she'd done, like, you know, open fantasy, so I thought, oh, is it something similar to that?
Yeah, this one's high fantasy.
I need it. I need to just read more damn high fantasy.
It's a very good story.
So bad.
Next we have Ed. What are you reading?
I am reading a piece from the inaugural issue of Firelight. It's a piece that I wrote, and it's called Sunset on the North Bank. You look at the creature at your feet, up at the setting sun over the horizon, broken by rooftops and distant towers, back at the form under your boot. It does not speak, just looks at you, eyes baleful and wide. Once again, you can scarcely meet them. There is a gun in one hand, your left, a powder charge hastily torn free from the careful rose hung from the bandolier beneath your outer coat, is gripped in your other. Delicately, fingers interlaced with the scouring rod. It feels like the sun creeps ever lower, its crimson flares clinging to the clouds like fingers of a doomed man clinging to a cliff edge. You never gave it this much thought, simply gave chase blindly, not stopping to consider what catching the figure pinned under the leather and rawhide of your jackboots would even begin to mean. It ran, and you gave heedless chase. Through the twisting streets, on and on, down through Dockside from the marketplaces, across the river to here, an almost cul-de-sac square opposite Basquitra's, not far into the riverside, but deep enough. You feel the eyes, hidden, seeing but unseen from the depths of the coffee house, from the very walls and half-streets around you. They stare at you, at the sprawled figure on the rough cobblestones, at the split satchel with its faded brand on the smooth, worn hessian, at the mail packets built around it. In your head, you hear a voice. You know the law. Indeed you do, seminar after seminar, drilled into you like the bore of your rifle left forgotten by your watchpost up the hill and across the river. The master bailiff's voice has never quite said those words, but you know his travailed voice well enough that he needn't have. With those ghost words, a decision is made. Somewhere in the back of your mind, it bubbles forward, lending steel to your spine, squareness to your shoulders, resolve to your hands. You pat down your coat with a handful of powder, transferring your scouring rod to the hand that now grips the barrel of your pistol, ready to load. You do not find your shot. For a moment, the decision falters, resolve wavering with the memory of that crucial pouch hung from a hook in the barrack still. The echo of those invented words resound in silence within your head. Then you spy it. From the dying rays of the twilight sun, the crimson wax impressed, silver ribbon seal. Slowly you pack the powder down. In lieu of shot, you do not remove the rod, leaving it there, jutting ever so slightly from the barrel. Instead, you slowly lower the wheel lock down towards the ground, to the child at your feet, prostrate under your boot. The hidden eyes see the flash, even though yours do not. Their eyes hear the crack and boom, just as yours do. You do not see the rush of petticoated figures from Basquitra's. You saw them even before they came. When the heat of the chase faded and you realised where you stood and what you must do. Even in the sea of patrons surge across the cobbles, you fall to your knees, desperately scrabbling for that red-sealed packet to hold it to the sparks of your wheel lock. Again and again, it does not catch. It falls from your hand, singed but intact, as their hand sees you. You do not see the twisted mimicry of the setting sun scarce hours later, as the North Bank erupts into flames.
We're going to end the episode with a serialization, and this piece is by Leela.
Instead of being one story split into three, this is three short stories set in the same universe. So I've called this serial The Rain Has Been Falling for Several Weeks Now, and the Government Has Done Nothing About It. And each one takes place at a different point in time in this universe. So this is the second piece in my serialisation, and it's called Shelter. In this piece, there's a content warning for depictions of rape. If that kind of stuff bothers you, please don't listen to this piece. You give your mother an open-handed slap.
Her skin is soft and prune-like from the constant damp, and it ripples under your palm. You draw your hand back. It's shaking now. You look up at your mother's eyes and watch them bulge with fat tears. I didn't mean to, you stammer. You've made your stance perfectly clear, she says. Her voice is as dull as the flint she lights the fire with, and then it cracks. Why don't you just go? Go. You scrub your wet cheeks and scamper past her without looking back. You barrel past the soup tables thronged with families, past the piles of dirty sheets, and you head through the doors away from the main hall. Some men in white carrying giant soup canteens swerve out of your path, putting distance between you and their spotless suits. The rain has begun to seep into niches in the corridors. There is a magnificent painting of a white curly-haired woman in a crown on the wall near the exit, and it's been there as long as you can remember. A crevice opened above it yesterday, and now a tiny bluster of rainfall causes water tracks to creep down the woman's face. You stop to look. She seems so lifelike now, with rivulets snaking their way into her eyes and down her cheeks, dripping onto the ripped red carpeting. You cup your hands beneath the painting and collect a puddle in your palms. You're about to put it to your lips when you notice something peculiar. There are strange flakes in the water. You frown and hold your handful up towards one of the fires, and each tiny fragment lights up in shades of peach and copper. You look at the portrait and notice that the places where the water has run over it have begun to strip down, specks of paint being carried by the flow. You tilt the glittering water in your hands, making it catch in the light, before you throw it away. It's pretty, but you can't drink it now. You leave the building and stand on the porch. The water laps at the top step, just below your feet, and you look out at the world beyond. You imagine the city, as your mother told you, with electric billboards gleaming on every single corner, and open-air food stands serving crepes and cakes and barbecued meat. Streets filled with clothes of more colours than you know, air that is cool and dry at night. All that's left now are three of the tallest towers that still poke out from the water. As you edge around the side of the building, you let the soft patter of rain slick your hair and catch in your upturned mouth, making your lips wet and shiny and lubricating your throat. You produce a shard of mirror that you found at the back of the stage and smile at yourself, tilting your head in a three-quarter position, pressing your finger to your mouth. You look so mature. The man in white at the back door nods at you as you approach and lets you in. You clamber over the fallen folding chairs strewn across the floor of the small landing and begin to ascend the concrete stairs. They go up and up in a square grey spiral, past various doors leading to the back, leading back to the hall, until eventually you find yourself below the storage attic. You shin up the ladder and knock on the trapdoor, and you immediately hear his nasal voice. "Come in." Sergeant Brown has been drinking today. His eyes are bloodshot and there is a deep stain across his belly that moves as it gently rises and falls. His breath smells similar to the alcohol the white men rubbed on your arms last time you fell and last time you fell and they got cut open on the glass. "Have you got it?" you ask. He pulls out the soup flask from his bag and smiles as you bolt the trapdoor behind you. You are left alone with him in the roof. You etch a smile on your face in return. "What would you like today?" "All right, we'll start sitting," he says, and pats the dusty arms of his seat before clumsily fingering open the flies of his trousers. "After I've finished, I'll decide where we go from there." You shuck off your dress and let it fall to your ankles before you clamber over his knee. You can smell cheese and salt, and you barely keep your gag reflex in check. As he lines up with you and begins pushing you down, your eyes catch a flash of light from the corner of the room, and you turn your head to see that for once he's left the window open. From such a great height, you can see all the way to the horizon. The water there is broken up by one or two tiny shadows. You wonder what those distant peaks are. You feel a sharp pain that drags you back. The room around you is stuffy and close. All the heat from the hall has risen here, and it swirls around the pair of you, trapped, the window not big enough to let it all out. You gag and stare desperately back out at the faraway line where the clouds turn into reflections. Your mother found out yesterday when you threw up your food. She took you to the men in white, cradling you in her arms despite your age, and begged them to help. You were whisked away behind white curtains and people poked you and prodded you and asked you to pee. They handed you back with a positive pregnancy test and an order written down on a tiny white piece of paper. Return for termination on Sunday. You finally told her where you'd been going. She begged you to never go back. She wouldn't need the soup, she said. The rations were ready enough. You don't need to. Your sister and I are fine. And then she'd burst into tears. This morning she'd grown angry and forbade you from going. She tried to restrain you. You don't even want to do this, she said. You slapped her and you left. You didn't watch her cry. You feel a pulse and a swell within you and you pull up as fast as if you'd been burned. There is a wet pot beneath you. What are you doing? Go back down. I'm not done, says the sergeant. You hesitate. You look down at his red-stained face, at the eyes glaring into yours from between greased skin folds. You think of what your mother might look like when she cries. You pull against his grip on your wrist. He smacks you across the face so hard that tears bead in your eyes, but he's caught off guard from your movement. You manage to slip your wrist away and scramble off his knee across the floor. He surges after you, hands outstretched. You back away until you feel the air of the window against your spine. He grabs for you with all his strength, but you duck. Unable to stop the momentum, his knees crash into your balled-up form and he trips over you before hurtling straight out the window. There are 3 seconds in which you hear nothing. Sergeant Brown does not scream. There is just you, naked on the floor, the rain-damp brick, and the sea behind. You wait for the splash, but you don't hear one. There is only the crunch of hundreds of bones breaking at once, as instead the sergeant hits the patio. You do not struggle when they put you in the boat. It isn't a big boat like the ones the men in white use. It is wooden, and it comes with fishing tackle and a pair of oars. The last person you speak to is not your mother, but General Morgan's, clutching her walking stick tightly through her shiny white suit. She gives you an umbrella and a backpack full of supplies. "Can I see my mother before I go?" you asked, as you stash them under one of the seats. She shakes her head. "I'm sorry, dear," she says, and behind the dim plastic of her goggles, you can see the tired green of her wrinkled eyes. You don't bother arguing further. Before you, the sea stretches away endlessly. Behind, the shelter stands firm, though it seems as old and tired as Morgan's herself as the rain continues to finger into its foundations. You've read stories of departures in books from before the rain. The hero sets off on a quest, usually to save the people he loves. He fights villains at every turn, but in the end, he discovers treasure beyond his wildest dreams. You blink, wondering if tears will come. They don't. Instead, you put up your umbrella and slot it into the holder on the side of the boat. You look out towards the line where the clouds turn into reflections. "Take care of him for me," you smile.
Thank you all for listening to this episode of Off the Page, brought to you by the Creative Writing Society and University Radio Nottingham. For more information about the Society, be sure to visit uncws.com and come back next week for more writing by the Creative Writing Society.
This is URN.